money, 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 little money, 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 money.
Oy, 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 oy.
Lovely money. It's on the reds.
International Detective Dragons from Outer Space.
Hello and welcome, or welcome back to International Detective Dragons from Outer Space. I'm Adam 5, and thank you very much for downloading and listening to episode 56. The question to be pondered in this episode is, money was once a tool of civilization. Has it now become a tool that uses us? In this episode, we'll hear from Hurt the Camera Guy, Tyson of the Northwest, Kyle, or Hobbit, and James. Whatever it cost you to get hold of this audio, well, that stops here. The rest of what you'll now listen to is at no charge, and it comes your way right after this.
This is the BBC Home Service. Enter a short idiot.
Good evening, folks. I commence by walking backwards for Christmas.
Why?
It's all the rage.
Please remove that false bald woman's wig.
And leave myself naked at the mating season? Never.
Very well. I sentence you to the highly esteemed Goon Show.
They can go home today. Presenting Wallace Greenslade and his daring announcement entitled...
Le Salaire de la Peur.
Meaning the wages of fear, or in England...
The fear of wages, oh!
Coherence. It's very difficult. Hi. Yeah, it's episode 56. This is going to be one of those, hey, you know, turn the microphone on and start talking. Otherwise, it's not going to happen. Very nearly no show this weekend. Very nearly no show whatsoever. Almost. But couldn't let that happen. I can't let that happen, and I won't let that happen. I think that's a Simpsons quote. But anyway, hello. Hi, how are you? Everything okay? I hope everything's okay. It'd be bad if it weren't. And if it isn't okay, well, change. Change happens, and it'll soon be okay. What about today's show? Well, I think I'm just going to get started with stuff that I should mention at the top of the show and not get too deeply, heavily into the topic itself until maybe later on, because it's going to have to be a two-parter. Why is that? Why is that, Adam? Well, I'm just not coherent enough about the topic. It's almost like Shakespeare. That whole topic of money as this whole topic of money as a tool that's now suddenly begun using us. Well, not suddenly anyway. Could go on for far longer than it needs to. In a way, two episodes is I guess a bit longer than it needs to, but really it's vaster. It is a vaster, broader topic than Shakespeare because, despite my Western Eurocentric tastes, Shakespeare is not known the entire world over nor revered quite as much as money. Anyway, let's get to it. Let's get to some welcomes to the forums. Let's welcome Ed. Yes, Ed has joined the forums, and I thank you very much. Tashkal joined the forums a while ago, and I never actually said thank you, because I missed it. I went and looked at the member list and saw, hey. And also, Des has joined. D-E-S, Des, has joined the forums. Thank you very much, Des. Also, we know him as Bragoon, who listens to us up in... Saskatchewan. I can do better than that. Saskatchewan, Canada. That's not a tough word to say, and I've said it many, many times. Sometimes I say it while putting salt on French fries and while waiting for the bus. when I have nothing else better to do but, say, Saskatchewan. Another favorite word of mine is archipelago. I think I've gone off track a bit here. Kurt, the camera guy, managed to get on the forums. Despite all the roadblocks that the software was throwing in his way, we managed to square that away. So good, thank you, and welcome very much, Kurt the camera guy. All of you, excellent. What next? That Frapper map thing. The Frapper map is kind of almost broken, pretty much, sort of, in a way. Something to do with the pins not displaying, I think, or the pins not being placed, or, I don't know, something or other screwy's going on with it. It takes a little bit of digging, or at least it took some digging on my part, to actually find some entries here that happened a while ago. Most recent one, of course, being Ed, who placed a picture, a puppeteer picture, adding to the photo gallery art. That's some pretty fine work there. If those are the kind of puppets you work with, wow, that's a class act. Those are very impressive. Fine craftsmanship. And thank you. Thank you very much for going ahead and testing that out. It helped me to discover that, yes, the Frapper map will register you if you add an image. It won't list you on the map for who knows what reason. I don't know what the reason is, but there it is. However, it does place you as a part of, needless to say, and of course, a fully-fledged member of the Stratospheric Veranda. Kyle also joined the Frapper map. Thank you, Kyle. Who else do we have? Rakshasa. Rakshasa. I just want to roll the R there. A picture placed of a cartoon onion head with hollow dead eyes smoking a cigarette. It looks familiar. I don't know where it's from, but the quote that went with it. Hey, Animal 5, love the show, so I thought I'd join the veranda finally. I don't know how, well, actually, that was from the 4th. That was from April 4th. That Rakshasa placed a pin on, well, tried to place a pin. At least the artwork showed up. At least the image showed up in the collection of pictures. So that's what's broken about it. I can't tell if a new pin has been placed, but if I do a little digging, I can see that there's a new picture and that you, in fact, attempted to join, but Frapper Map wouldn't let you. Wouldn't let another individual here, an unidentified man in a cap with a neatly trimmed, close-cropped beard, who apparently the location is Pickering, Ontario, Canada. I don't know who you are. Hi, thank you. Thank you very much for joining the Frapper Map. But I have got a name to go with the face. And finally, back on February 24th, a trio of unidentified people from the Turanga Bay. Turanga, Bay of Plenty, New Zealand. Turanga. I don't know how that's pronounced. The Bay of Plenty in New Zealand, and the quote that went with that was, Kia ora, my friends, from the southern hemisphere, it's lonely down here. Well, sorry about that. I guess in a way, I'm a little envious because it's certainly very, very crowded in the New York metropolitan area and most of the northern eastern part of New Jersey. You can't there's no direction you can walk in for 15 minutes without running into a building, a domicile, a group of people, a road, something. And, you know, Lord of the Rings pictures were filmed right where you guys are. Three unidentified men with what appear to be toy guns and a picture that also appears to have been taken at night with a flash. Don't know who you are. I'd love to say hello, but I do thank you very much for joining the Frapper Map. Was that it? Actually, yes, it is it, because I'm 2 weeks behind in all of my podcast listening, and I mean 2 weeks. If anybody has played my promo, made mention of the show, referred to either myself or IDDFOS or any of that stuff, I'm sorry I missed it because I haven't been listening for something like 2 weeks. Time. There just ain't enough of it. And that's for sure. There was cardboard built. There was cardboard kitty scenery built and no rant recorded. I apologize, but it was one of those things where I had to get it out the door. And the last couple of times that I did the cardboard corrugated rants, the lunatic rants, the chrysotunities of warehouse recording, well, I just slowed myself down to the extent that it took nearly three times as long to get the stuff built and out the door. So instead, I downloaded and listened to about 50 previous episodes of Geek Label Radio. And it was kind of fun to listen to some call-in stuff from like a year ago. Hearing Dickie of the Stealth Geek podcast, hearing Kurt from the Wandering Geek podcast, and emails being read and stuff like that from long ago. Just hearing some familiar names mentioned on there. But it was a little embarrassing, too, to find that there was a segment of that show called... Well, it asks a question. A question is asked. As the show progressed, there were more questions. And which is a great thing. I mean, it prompts email responses, and it's, you know, certainly it's by no means a unique thing. And so it's a smart move and can result in some very interesting stuff. But what was embarrassing about it was I'd found that some of these past questions that I've done, like over the past couple of months, were already done on Geek Label Radio, and I had no idea. So I feel a little bit foolish for not having listened to them before and knowing that that, in fact, was the case. But I'm more knowledgeable now. And maybe I'll work a little bit harder to come up with some more unique questions. There certainly can't be any broader question than the one for this episode and for episode 57, because we are going to carry it over into 57. It's just too broad a topic. But in the meantime, I only have one additional thing before we get to the emails and the listener responses for this episode, and that is a link. I'm going to put a link in the Goodikadingadongadungs to something that I found cool. I have no other reason for putting it in this show other than to say I found this really, really cool and practical and impressive. It's an MP3 player. It's called the EMP MX71. That's the model number. It's the EMP MX71. You can go ahead and Google it if you don't want to look for it, or if the link doesn't work anymore. What is it? Well, it's the next MP3 player I'm going to get, because... No, I'm knocking on wood, because I want the one I'm using to last very long. The one I'm using plays burnt CDs with MP3s on it, so I can get something like 46 hours worth of audio just listening to the one that I have. It doesn't have a memory card. It just plays CDs that have MP3s burned on them. But it uses batteries, so I'm buying batteries every week or two to replace in this thing. This MP3 player charges its own internal battery with an internal built-in generator. It's wind-up. It has a crank. Like 8 years ago, there was a radio flashlight combo that had a wind-up crank on the side, built-in generator, and it generated its own power when you wound the crank. Well, this MP3 player will play for half an hour if you turn the crank for 1 minute. Which I think is probably a pretty fair trade-off. Follow the link, check it out, take a look at it. It does quite a bit more than that. What I like best about it is no more paying $5 and up for a pack of batteries every week or two, and just being able to charge the thing by turning a generator crank on the side. And it doesn't look like it's built... It doesn't look like something that was forged at a giant factory somewhere... In Siberia. It has a pretty decent look. So check that out. I think it's very economical too, I suppose. So it does have some kind of a tie-in to this show. And of course it's earth-friendly, because it doesn't produce wasted batteries. Alright. That's enough of me. This is probably one of the most uninspiring beginnings to any International Detective Dragons from Outer Space episode, but I did manage to avoid the topic of cat poop, and so I guess it has that going for it. We'll take a little break and then come back in a bit.
Part 1, The Missing Regiment.
Burma, 6th of March, 1956.
These Japs can't hold out much longer.
Oh, I don't know. This is the 14th year we've been fighting them.
Don't worry, Major. They can't stand much more of your drunken singing and bottle throwing.
I'm only doing my duty, sir. And they'd better surrender soon. We've had no food or pay since that silly telegram.
Telegram? You know it. Give it here.
Oh.
British forces Burma. Japan has surrendered. End of World War II. Book now for World War III.
Okay, I'm going to lead off the show. Not the show. I'm going to lead off the beginning of the emails with, this is really sad. I've done this before. This is episode 56. I've done this before. I can speak. Let me try again. I lost an email. And I think I made mention of this in the last show. It was from Kurt the Camera Guy. And I don't know how I misplaced this. It was right there among the others. Why didn't I bring it up and paste it in with what needed to be read for the show? Don't know. But here it is now. Let's correct the situation. Subject line is, guess who's coming to dinner? And Kurt writes, hey, Adam. I finally got around to heading over to the IDD FOS homepage and saw that there was indeed a topic for episode 55. You might get more responses to these things if you put them in the audio portion of the show. I know. I confessed. I already did my mea culpa bit on that one, but yes, you're right, indeed, 'tis true. Although, I suppose it is a way to get folks to go to the website. Now, I could probably come up with some great and lofty answers for what living person I would want to have dinner and conversation with. Stephen Hawking and Peter Jackson leap to mind, obviously for different reasons. I'd love to spend some time with Richard Garfield to talk about how he came up with the whole idea of collectible card games, or maybe Alan R. Moon to try to understand where he gets all the ideas for the great games he designs. But anyone who actually knows me would say there's only one answer, for better or worse, regardless of how shallow it may sound, and that is Charmed star Alyssa Milano. I've been a huge fan for years, and have been actively collecting every movie and television show she has ever been in that has been released on DVD. Heck, she even got me to watch a few episodes of that show My Name is Earl, not my usual fare. I've gone so far as to enter a Major League Baseball contest to go see the Los Angeles Dodgers game with her, even though I haven't been to a baseball game in 15 years. Not a fan. And I'm really bummed that she's going to be at the Comic-Con, L.A., this weekend, and I don't have the chance to go. So it may not be lofty or cast me in an intellectual light, but I can say it's honest. All the best, Kurt. Can anybody argue with that at all? I sure can't. Well, I mean, Alyssa Milano, absolutely gorgeous and well-known and talented actress that I remember most and know most and most familiar with her work from My Cousin Vinny. Just a superior job there. That whole bit where she's thoroughly disgusted with the fact that Joe Pesci's going to go hunting and he wants to know from her what pants she thinks would work best. If you haven't seen the film, please go see it. I'm not even going to try. I won't even describe it. Not even the lines. You have to see it. It's just excellent. So, yeah, hey, nobody said it had to be, a nuclear physicist, or it had to be somebody, like James Burke, or it's a question of who you personally would want to sit down to dinner with one evening. Not specifically who you'd look best with, what would cast you in the best light. It's like, well, look who he chose. He must be, what conclusions can you really reach about somebody based on who you see them sitting and having dinner with? You know, unless it's a real life situation and it has to do with politics and spies and international intrigue and stuff like that. No, I haven't got any clue what I'm talking about. I haven't even said thanks to Kurt for writing in. Thank you very much for that honest answer. And if anybody else wants to be a little less lofty and send in an answer that's as honest as Kurt's, you're more than welcome to do so, whether you've written in before or not. This actually happens to be one of those questions that, or at least a close, very close approximation of one of those questions that I heard asked on that collection of Geek Label Radio podcasts that I downloaded and listened to. I think theirs was, who would you have dinner with, living or dead? But this particular question I yoinked from George Robb in passing as I heard it while we were doing our Skype chat number 7. Okay. Thank you very much, Kurt the Camera Guy. Now, tying in directly with that, I'm going to pull an entry from the forums, and this was entered by Tyson of the Northwest. And he writes,
I echo comments of James, I think, on the difficulty of coming up with a single person to have dinner with who's alive today and I wouldn't fanboy out about. A one-on-one meeting would just be awkward and difficult to get a good conversation going.
Yeah, that's reality-based and absolutely true. I mean, when you come right down to it, really.
So why settle for one when you can have a dinner party? That way, I can be involved in shaping the conversation of a great meeting of modern minds. I am thinking a hearty meal with simple but well-prepared foods, a complimentary wine, a light dessert, and then a chat around a large room with overstuffed chairs, perhaps a pool table.
This comes very close to the Steve Allen special series called Meeting of the Minds. I think that's what it was called. Yeah, Meeting of the Minds, where he came up with a series of shows where great figures from history in science and politics were all brought together for these roundtable type discussions. If I remember correctly, it ended up being more about how well the actors were dressed and could portray their characters more than about the ideas being traded among all these different people. At least that's the impression I got. I don't know. It's been a while since I saw them, a very long while, because that was like from the 70s, early 70s, late 60s. Or I'm entirely wrong. My brain is Swiss cheese, and I can't remember when it came out. Steve Allen, Meeting of the Minds, I'll have to look it up. But he has split choices here among different categories for the groups of people that he thought it would be cool to get together and have one of these sitting around sniffing brandy in the overstuffed chairs after a nice comfy dinner. Here's one. He writes,
technology. For a pleasant dinner to discuss the limits of technology and how to get business to push them, I would want, as guests, James Burke, enough said, Amory Lovins, an energy researcher attributed with creating the concept of negawatt power. He grows bananas in the Rocky Mountains in a house with no furnace.
Amory Lovins, he was the one that was narrating that video that I linked to a couple of shows ago, I'm pretty sure. And one of the co-authors of Winning the Energy Endgame, or We Must Win the Oil Endgame, something like that. See, I put the link in, and I checked it out, and I can't even remember what it was that I put. Shame on me. But at least I recognize the name. I'm so proud of myself. Stop. Stop, Adam. Read.
Richard Branson has the resources to take an idea and run with it, plus enthusiasm and a good sense of humor. Dale Dougherty, editor and producer of Make Magazine. Under the topic of storytelling, discussing the mythic hero, the hero's journey, and the crafting of lasting stories, J. Michael Straczynski, Joss Whedon, Neil Gaiman, Mick Bradley.
Well, that's some pretty good company to be in there, Mr. Bradley. I see nothing wrong with you being a part of that list. You would probably take a step back and say, no, it shouldn't be me, it should be Joseph Campbell. No, I think I prefer to hear you grouped in with these other guys, and I think that's an excellent choice. All those guys for storytelling.
Mad Science, Kaja Folio of Girl Genius Comics.
If I'm mispronouncing that, I am sorry.
Shannon Garrity, Narbonic and Skin Horse Comics. Howard Taylor, Schlock Mercenary Comics. Jake Von Slatt, Steampunk Tinkerer. And Corey Doctorow, Generally Mad. Anyone else have 4 to 5 people they would invite as guests to a dinner?
That certainly widens the field, particularly if you say anyone that's living or dead. So I would go ahead and say, you know what, why not? Listen, episode 57, if anybody wants to add to this particular topic, I might as well. I stole the question twice over to begin with. I might as well run with it here. And I'm getting great input about it, particularly in terms of broadening the question and widening the options. So, yes, please. This is, it's just great to imagine, just to imagine these people together all in the same room, under different, disciplines or subjects, broad subjects. Thank you very much for that forum entry, Tyson of the Northwest. Excellent. I include this now because it would be wrong of me not to. Why would it be wrong? Well, I asked for it, and I'm very glad I got it. Stop being so cryptic. Annum five. It also is a forum entry, and it is from James, and it is the answer to the question that I asked because he just fleetingly, in passing, off the cuff, not even name dropping. It was just, oh yes, and by the way, he had dinner with Ray Bradbury, as we all found out in episode 55 from his letter then. Well, this is a forum entry explaining the whole background behind that. And here it is. Title of the forum entry is
Because You Demanded It.
Well, I didn't demand it. I'm not in a position to demand anything from anybody, but, I'm very glad that you're letting us in on it. Anyway, here we go.
Actually, the story is a bit fuzzy, as this was over 11 years ago. Basically, this was back when I was in school for my master's in library science. The school, the University of South Carolina, was having a fundraiser for the library to help pay for some major renovations, and the college was bringing in some pretty big literary names to host various events. Most of the names I had no interest in, and if you look over the New York Times bestseller lists since then, my viewpoint has been validated. However, I jumped at a $30 ticket to see Mr. Bradbury. I had to eat ramen noodles for almost an entire week to save on the cut that ticket took on my grocery budget, I do remember. I was one of the first people in line. However, I had no idea that my ticket, being one of the first ones sold, was granted the honor of sitting at the table with Mr. Bradbury, along with various university bigwigs. Needless to say that I was floored when I was led to my table and realized who I would be dining with. The food was only mediocre, but the man can certainly give a speech. His dinner speech was mainly concerned with how universities and libraries fed the need for knowledge, and he reminisced a bit about the old days, talked about his friendship with Ray Harryhausen, and how elated he was during the first moon landing, and how he called up Arthur Clarke, Isaac Asimov, and others to celebrate, even though it was past midnight, and he was in London at the time. Note, some of that might not be correct. I'm going from very old memories, and they have been known on more than one occasion to be faulty.
I think I can identify with you on that 100%. If anyone needs any reason for me to be identifying with that, all you have to do is listen to any other show. He continues.
The really sad thing about it all was that I had brought a copy of the Martian Chronicles hoping that there would be a signing afterwards. There wasn't. And I was so freaked out that I forgot to ask him to sign my book. And, well, that's all there is to tell. James.
And that's fine. Excellent. Curiosity satisfied? And what a great opportunity. You met the author of the Martian Chronicles, the Illustrated Man, the Halloween Tree. What else? Does Something Wicked This Way Comes? What else is, I could just go down the list of everything that Ray Bradbury has written. He did a lot of writing for radio in the 50s, or at least stories of his were adopted for old-time radio science fiction stories. Dimension X, I think, did quite a few stories that were his. So that's excellent. Great. I never actually spent that amount of time with somebody, with a famous author, or even anybody famous, at least in that close proximity. But that's excellent. Fantastic. Thank you. Thank you very much, James, for filling us in on the situation with Dinner with Ray Bradbury.
Dated August 1945?
Yes, yes. I've never shown it to you before because it was obviously the work of a practical joker.
Well, I can... I can only hope it is.
Stop, stop, stop! A Japanese officer is attacking us with the white flag, Ure.
Dead! And it's the new Mark III armor-piercing type white flag.
Oh, blimey, I'm off.
look, don't panic. I'll show that Jap a thing or two. Help me off with my job first now.
No, Major, please.
Out of my way.
Dear listeners, from the waist downwards, Bloodnock was tattooed with a pair of false legs. Facing the wrong way.
Yes, they're all the rage, you know.
This next is an email from Tyson of the Northwest. And he, the subject line is,
Thoughts on Jerks and Idols I Have Never Met.
And Tyson writes,
Hey, Adam. You mentioned your experience with Harlan Ellison in a recent podcast, soon after the mention of the passing of Gary Gygax, and I wanted to share my own feelings on both these people, since in my mind, they are linked in a way. When I was very young, a friend, I was so young I don't remember his name now, a friend of mine told me of this game his older siblings were playing with dragons and wizards. After a few visits to his house and getting to know his guinea pigs, I definitely remember the guinea pigs, and the origami, for some reason. He showed me one of the books. I was barely able to read at that point, but I saw magnificent pictures of monsters, heroes, and the occasionally scantily clad figure, both male and female. I could read and remember Dungeons and Dragons. Luckily for me, the local library had books like the D&D, the AD&D Dungeon Master's Guide, and the Dungeoneer Survival Guide. I read them cover to cover repeatedly, and dreamed of one day playing in a game. But that is a story for another time. The name that jumped out to me as being almost as mystical as the game was the name Gygax. I kept seeing it on the books. And as I grew and eventually started playing the game many years later, I began to hear more and more of Gary, his personality, his actions and whatnot, and I came to the conclusion that he was a bit of an ass. But even so, he was an important person to me, and though I never met him personally, he affected me more than some of my extended family. He became a part of my extended family. He was the uncle that no one really liked all that much, but gave you a full set of army men, complete with vinyl battlefield mat, that your parents accidentally left behind at the family Christmas gathering. Or surreptitiously slipped you your first copy of Heavy Metal magazine during your teen years. Ellison is similar. Not the most personable of people, but still important to me. When I was a teenager, Sci-Fi Channel just launched, and I was being introduced to shows like The Prisoner and Space 1999. They launched a show called Sci-Fi Buzz, where Harlan Ellison had his own rant segment. Sometimes I agreed with him, other times not, but he always had something interesting to say. As I was exposed to more of Harlan's works and antics, I came to the realization that he was a crotchety old man, and that he was pretty much always a crotchety old man. It is a persona he has cultivated over the years. It makes one wonder if, at a formative age, someone had introduced him to the phrase, too cantankerous to die, and he decided to live forever. If Gygax is an estranged uncle of our geek clan, Ellison is the curmudgeonly old grandpappy. Be seeing you, Tyson of the Northwest.
Thank you very much, Tyson. Well, fair enough. I made mention of Harlan Ellison because I was reading his stuff as he was coming out with it. And at the age of 14, because that's when that happened. Yes, it was. I was 14 years old. It was a sci-fi convention at Kane College in New Jersey, before it became Kane University. There was John Brunner, author of The Sheep Look Up. There was, oh, I can't remember the other names. But Harlan Ellison was there as well, and I walked up to him, and I've already told the story last week. But, yeah, as time goes on, you get to develop your opinions of who people are depending on what their public persona is supposed to be or not be. And I can certainly see them being cast in the role of the uncle that nobody particularly likes but is supremely interesting. Excellent insight and excellent sci-fi background tying into a fantasy background in a way that's probably affected quite a few of us in a very similar way. You know, as I listen to more and more shows, more and more podcasts that are geek-centric, it becomes clear to me that as unique as I always thought I was, boy, I sure wasn't. And I only wish I'd known that then, because I wouldn't have felt probably quite so isolated. Definitely would have known that there were hundreds of thousands more like me across the country and across the world, other than the two or three people that I knew in high school that were kind of similar into the D&D, into the science fiction, just like you. So thank you once again. Next up, this email from Kyle, also known as Hobbit. And the subject line is
Musings from a Frazzled Coder.
And he writes,
Hi, Adam 5. Sorry for not writing for a while. Got the flu. This winter's been miserable. And getting ready for a business trip. Joy, joy. I did place my pin in the Frapper map, so let me know if you get notification of it or not. And if I don't reply before the weekend, it's because I'm on my trip and can't access my email. Now, onto the topics. First off, if I had to choose someone living to have a meal with, I would have to choose either Steve Wozniak, the computer designer, or Steve Jackson, the game designer. I had a variety of Apple II computers growing up, so I want to pick Steve Wozniak's brain on how he created them. And I love Car Wars and GURPS, so I would love to learn how Steve Jackson does his craft. And I wish Gary Gygax were still around. And as for if we own money or money owns us, I unfortunately believe that money owns us. I know with my job and me spending way too much money this year, it seems that I'm spending more and more time at work and not enough time with my family. And it seems that Americans are doing that more and more. Hopefully we'll wake up and smell the coffee, myself included, and learn that there is more than going to work to get a paycheck. Well, off to eat, rest a little, and go to bed, so I can get to the airport bright and early in the morning. Have fun. Kyle. Also known as Hobbit.
Interesting tagline, too, or signature line, on Kyle's email.
Striving to make the world better one program at a time.
It can be done. One way or another. Thank you. Thank you very much, Kyle. Yes. Yes, indeed. Two very interesting and influential individuals. Perfectly valid choices. Honestly, anybody picked is a valid choice. As I said in the last episode, it's a personal question. It's who's important to you. Doesn't matter what I think of it, actually, or anybody else. But it's certainly understandable. Yeah, Americans are doing it more and more. Everybody all over the world is doing it more and more. And this is not something that's changed much in probably 6,000 years. Some differences being that, major differences, of course, being that some people were doing it in order to keep from being killed and continue to be fed. I think they are referred to in every history and every culture as slaves. However, they were referred to as slaves, I think, because they didn't have a choice. Here in the modern world, of course, we have a choice to not work and not earn any money. Then, of course, we won't have to worry about anything except maybe where to live and how to eat. Wait a minute. Oh, I'm not going to start getting into it thoroughly just yet. Besides, it's not quite that dark a road I'm going to go down, because that's just... First of all, it's old news. It's nothing anybody else hasn't talked about already, so I'm not going to do that. And it'll sound a bit too much like whining. Things are what they are. But it's a valid, it's an absolutely valid point you make, that there is more than going to work to get a paycheck. There's more to life than earning money. The difficulty is, oh, we'll get into the difficulties later on. I'm just glad that you wrote in, and lots of luck on the business trip. Although, by the time you've heard this, you may actually already be back. So I hope it went well. Thank you once again, Kyle.
Quick, Matt!
Gad, what a day this has been. A triumph for British arms. Now, I must inform the War Office that after 14 years of fighting, the Japanese army in that tree has finally surrendered! Dial on, brave telephone. Send those triumphant electric type impulses athwart the sleeping continents to the automatic type exchanges in London. And list. Even now sounds the tintinnabulation of the phone bell that will arouse the helmsman of England, to whom I carry the victorious news.
Back to cheat dog zone, mate.
Curse! Wrong number.
Next up, this email, once again from Tyson of the Northwest. Subject line is...
Thoughts on Transitive States and Batman.
And Tyson writes...
With all of that fanfare you've given me, I owe you something not quite as rambling or as poorly spelled as my last email. Well, at least I can promise better spelling.
There isn't a soul that writes into this show, or has written into this show, that owes me a thing. I think it would be far more accurate to say that I am indebted to the listeners, and particularly the listeners that have written in. Okay, let me just, it's very simple for me to stop and say just that and continue with the letter, and so that's what I'm going to do.
I've heard it said that life can be broken up into moments of transition and moments of reflection. Moments of transition drive us to be the person we are becoming, with every new idea, new experience, and new action. We become more and more than we were. Without this, we would not learn, we would not innovate, would not grow, but we cannot survive a life in constant transition. To grow without bounds causes confusion, waste, and the discarding of immediate opportunities for unrealized potentials. Reflection is how you integrate what you're becoming into what you are. Without reflection, you pursue pathways of thought and being without evaluating them consciously or critically. But to retreat into reflection is just as dangerous as unhindered transition. You can trap yourself in what you should have done, what you could have done. You can become comfortable here, your dreams of the future overshadowed by the comforts of the past.
I think I've actually become mired like that personally for long periods of time. I've fallen into that, can you really call it a pit? I guess it depends on who you are and what your experiences are, but you can fall into that pit of introspection that becomes very difficult to get out of. Moving forward is a very active thing that requires motivation. Sometimes the motivation is forced on you. That's an excellent point, and very well put. He continues.
On one hand, squandered opportunity, on the other, opportunity ignored. Only when a path is charted that crosses the bounds of both these two states can you avoid their pitfalls. The trick of it is figuring which is the most appropriate. I'll get back to you when I have found a clue how to determine that. Be seeing you, Tyson, of the Northwest.
I think I just heard an eloquent version of life is like a tightrope. And I think it's just as true as any other version that you'd hear. The best way to move forward is to not continuously look back The other best way to move forward, make progress, improve your state of being, improve your rate of growth, if you want to put it that way, is to not spend 100% of your time in contemplation. There is a P.S., and it has to do with Batman versus Spider-Man, and so I will continue with that. This also by Tyson of Northwest from the same email.
As for Batman versus Spider-Man, Batman wins, hands down. Yes, Spider-Man has all his superhuman powers that make him better than the average human, plus the freed geek ID when in the costume. I mean, really, half the time I think his enemies have a tendency to hound him is because of his snarky retorts.
Did I read that right? I think I did.
But Batman, remove all his expensive toys, and he is human perseverance personified. Let's look at the formula of alien invasion in Justice League. Aliens, realizing that there are superhumans, determine their weaknesses and neutralize them. Batman, being a normal human, is looked on as not a threat since he has no superhuman ability. Calamity ensues until at the most inopportune moment, Batman defeats, breaks the aliens' hold on the supers, and the day is saved. Sure, if you drop Spidey and Bats in a room with no preparation or warning and have them duke it out, Spidey will probably come out on top. But any conflict after that, or give Bruce any time to prepare, and Pete is in for a thrashing. Because if defeating Parker is Batman's goal, he will find a way. It may take a while, but he will. I mean, this is the guy Kent relies on that, in the event that Superman becomes a threat to humanity, will take him out quickly and effectively.
All right, fair enough. I was going through sheer practicality, mainly that scenario of, okay, drop them both in a room with no preparation or warning, and basing it purely on the abilities, the individual abilities. I don't know. I guess in a way there are certain irritating things I can find about Peter Parker that would be flaws that don't particularly have to do with his fighting skill or ability to defeat an enemy, but I can understand the argument. I can understand the reasoning. And thank you. Thank you very much for your input on that particular topic, which I think was introduced offhand. Yeah, it was introduced towards the end of an email by James. But thank you very much, Tyson of the Northwest. Speaking of James Stubbs. This last email of this episode is from him. The subject line is,
money is like a sixth sense, and you can't make use of the other five without it.
That being a quote from William Somerset Maugham. Somerset up and the Somerset Maugham suite. All right. James writes,
money, get back. I'm all right, Jack.
I'm not going to start singing. No, not going to sing. Pink Floyd did it better, but he's quoting Pink Floyd here.
Money, get back. I'm all right, Jack. Keep your hands off of my stack. Money, it's a hit. Don't give me that do-goody-good bullish. Sorry, Annam. The Pink Floyd song, Money, immediately came to mind when I saw the topic for episode 56. I guess the real question that is posed by your question is that if money is no longer a physical object and has taken on anthropomorphic qualities of its own...
Bingo, you hit the nail on the head.
After all, how could an inanimate object use us? The gut reaction is to say, no. Until you look at things like the drugs that are flooding our streets, they're definitely using people. But are they really, or are they just the means to an end by very unscrupulous people? I mean, money is a tool. It always has been. By definition, a tool is defined as anything used as a means of accomplishing a task or purpose. The original task of money was to facilitate trade in a simpler manner than me lugging in 2 cows, 5 chickens, and the polished tooth of a wolf on a leather strip to haggle for a gallon of milk and a Snickers bar at the Walmart. So money unto itself isn't evil, the same way that a gun isn't inherently evil, if we want to draw an analogy to an earlier IDDFOS episode. It was created for a purpose, to achieve a task, and does so efficiently and effectively, for good or ill.
More Pink Floyd quoting here.
Money, it's a crime. Share it fairly, but don't take a slice of my pie. Money, so they say, is the root of all evil today. But if you ask for a raise, it's no surprise that they're given none away. Well, the problem comes with the concept of capitalism, basically the need to profit. And, yes, I realize that's a horrible oversimplification. I'm not going to be one of those people who cries from the mountaintops that capitalism is bad. I love my material possessions that such a system has made possible for me to own. I love my material possessions. I love my... Oh, man, this is tough. I love my material possessions that such a system has made possible for me to own too much to condemn it.
There we go. Wow, Reading Comprehension 101, Adam. That was tough. That was a tough one.
But like most things, there are those individuals that take things either too literally or way too far and don't give a damn about the consequences.
That last sentence pretty much sums up what prompts the whole subject for this episode in general. And I'm on the same boat with you on that, James, so far as capitalism goes. I won't say that I approve of capitalism, that it's a good thing, but I also don't. I don't approve of communism. I don't approve of any other ism, economic or political. I don't approve of any of it. It's all wrong. All of it. It's all incorrect. Any system that requires some people to do some things while other people don't is broken. Civilization itself, whether the workers of the world unite and throw off their chains, doesn't work. And I like my material possessions too. But that last sentence, individuals that take things either too literally or way too far and don't give a damn about the consequences, is key to part of what prompts the question on a specific scale. How about I just continue with the rest of the letter?
These are the same individuals pushing the concept of globalization. This isn't altruism, folks. It's a way to exploit foreign countries for their workforce and cheaper goods to maximize profits at the expense of everything else. Honestly, does anyone believe that the executives at these companies earning multi-million dollar salaries really care about the domestic factories they're closing down and putting people out of work if they can make the annual stockholder report look good by upping the profits? I mean, what do they care? They're going to go home to an extravagant house every night, and they don't have to worry about their job because even if they get canned, they've got their golden parachutes already set up for them. The crux of the problem comes when you realize that these people, the ones who control the money and have based their lives on nothing but the acquisition of more and more money, have rewritten the rules of society. Money is no longer just a tool in this new game. It is a status symbol, a measure of your worth in society, there for no other reason than flaunting the fact that you have it. It is a measure of how successful you are. Job satisfaction, personal empowerment, or just enjoying being a slacker pales in comparison to keeping up with the Joneses. Our society doesn't place any value on intangible things anymore. If you can't send your kids to the best schools, buy a new car every X number of years, or dress in the newest fashion, you're not successful. And money is the means to get those nice things.
And once again, the question of scale comes in here. Everything that you have said is absolutely true. And it's absolutely true when you look at the situation from a very specific distance. When you look at it at a very specific level of detail. The level of detail that that whole last paragraph covers is the whole concept of the average human being, whether in the United States or anywhere else in the world, keeping up with the Joneses, whatever their names happen to be in whatever country they're in. Yeah, the definition of success and the definition of what you are worth, how valuable you are, isn't dependent on the fact that you're a human being to begin with, but what you own. That on a very specific level. James continues.
Money has transgressed past the point of economic value for telling me how much buying power my paycheck has into social value. And quite frankly, folks, we should be scared as hell. The only thing saving most of us middle-class working people is the fact that we provide the bulk of the taxes to the government. I think it's pretty much been established for years now that everything can be bought, from political offices to getting away with murder, and that everyone has their price. So, no, money is not a tool using us. We're merely dancers prancing about to the fiddler's tune, and we'll continue to be until we wise up and stop listening to their noise. And holy crap, have I just rambled and probably made little sense at what I just spewed out. Sorry, James Stubbs.
No, that wasn't a ramble, and you made perfect sense. Made perfect sense. On a very specific scale, again, on a very specific level of detail, the final paragraph, money is not a tool using us, we're dancers prancing about to the fiddler's tune, the fiddlers, of course, in this case being, I don't know, world corporate powers, government powers, essentially the folks that are deciding where the money goes and how it's used and what we owe, we being Joe and Janet Public, the average schmo. Yeah. The idea of wising up and not listening to their noise, again, that also depends on a very specific scale. If you decided that it is perfectly comfortable, if you are perfectly comfortable living in an apartment and not really living beyond your means, but having a certain number of friends, I got to go back and find the email that Sarah sent when we were talking about what is important, because it really kind of nailed it so far as what you would consider what you would consider important. If you have a comfortable place to live, if you have fun and interesting friends, if you have enough to eat, then essentially you're there. That's it. Shelter, food, friends, I guess entertainment, you know, interesting things to do, then that's important. How much money does that really take anymore? Unless you've decided somehow that you your friends are not fun or interesting and you are not entertained unless you're taking regular plane trips to Aspen to go on ski trips, and then maybe you just don't feel personally fulfilled unless you happen to belong to a country club in Boca Raton, and that you can't spend your summers in Europe. I don't know. It's all a level of scale. It's all a question of scale. So economically, that's certainly, I think, feasible for a great many people, or at least it would be a lot more feasible if it weren't for people in control of funds that are taking things a bit too far. I'm going to go into probably a little bit more about where the question came from and how further I want to explore it after we go to a little bit of a break here. So thank you very much, James, for writing in. All excellent points. Very specifically dealing with the topic for this show in a very in-depth way. And so I'm going to continue with just a bit more about it after we come back from the break. Actually, no, that's wrong. That would jump the rails for how this show is structured. Shame on me. What we're supposed to find out now is what the old-time radio show for episode 56 is going to be. And we'll do that when we come back from the break, back in a bit.
Truth is stranger than fiction. This is the proof. This is Ripley. Aunt Rika made a shroud for every person who died in a German community for a period of 41 years and always appeared at the doomed one's home 72 hours before a death, believe it or not. In a moment, I'll tell you the strangest crime detection in all history. The story of Jonas Rushford would challenge the imagination of some of our greatest super sleuths. When Jonas was a boy of 12 in Bromley, England, he was hypnotized by Timothy Crowther. While under the hypnotic spell, he solved the mystery of the disappearance of John Simpson of Bramley by looking into a mirror. Jonas said he saw two thugs kill Simpson and conceal his body in an abandoned coal mine. The police found the victim and captured the killers, believe it or not.
Money, 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 little money, 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 money. Oh, yo, 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 yo. Lovely money. It's all the rage.
Moriarty, shh. Pull that transparent blind down, you fool. Now, have you sewn that £10,000 into the lining of your socks?
Yes.
Then help me get this £100 in fivers under my wig.
Right. Down in your right hand. Back a bit. Right. My finger. There.
Well, before I begin my ramblings, before I start talking about this whole money situation, let's find out what the old-time radio genre nugget for episode 56 is. All right, how do we find that out? We find that out by me saying it out loud with my mouth. Children's fair, juvenile, but fun. Let's hear a short snippet from Jerry at the Circus.
For Jerry of the Circus.
She was dainty and she was sweet, and I was passing down the street when I and
Colonel, it's me, Jerry.
Ah, Jerry. Oh, yes, yes, of course, my boy. Come right in, yes.
My, it's sure dark in here.
Yes, yes, such nonsense, such foolishness. You think I was a babe in arms, wouldn't you? Shut the door, Jerry. I said I'm supposed to stay in the dark. Such goings on.
I had no idea how dark these wagons could be.
At my age, to come down to the measles and then to be forced to stay in the dark.
Yeah, I know. I sure hated it when I had the measles. But I guess the doctors know what they're doing.
Know what they're doing? Da-bah. Jerry, I've got the finest eyesight in the world. Never miss a thing. And to have a nincompoop doctor send me to bed and then to keep me there.
He was trying to get Mr. Randall to send you to the hospital.
What? Let the show go on without me, it can't be done.
I told Mr. Randall that Tom and I could take care of you. You see, we've both had the measles, so it's safe for us.
Oh, you did, Jerry. Well, now I call that real friendly. Yes, I sure
do. Say, we're only too glad to. Tom and I are buddies, and we'd be proud to take care of you.
Yes, yes. I hope Mr. Randall put that doctor in his place for suggesting the hospital.
Well, you see...
Now, come, my boy, out with it.
Well, he said he'd see how you got along and how well Tom and I manage. Mr. Randall said he'd be by here later.
He'd better. If he thinks he can put Colonel Charles Wyndham Alger in a hospital, he's got another thought coming.
It's lucky Mr. Randall's had the measles, too, or he wouldn't be able to come and see you. They say it's lots worse for grown-ups than for children.
What is, Jerry?
The measles.
No, don't believe him, son. It's just that grown-ups fuss more than children. Yes, sir. That's what it is. Kids don't complain so much.
You're sure a good sport, Colonel.
From long ago, very stylized, very aimed at the youngsters of the age that listened to it. That whole episode that's from will be available, of course, as a direct link in the Kutikatingatongatongs for episode 56. Please give it a listen if you care to. Now then, what about this? Annum 5, why did you bring up the topic of money? And why do you think it's a tool that's using us? I'm starting to change, actually, my viewpoint on that in terms of it being a tool that's using us and going more along the lines of something that actually James mentioned in his letter, that of money attaining a kind of an anthropomorphic persona of its own. almost as an independent entity. I suppose it would be wise for me to define my terms here, because my thoughts on this, particularly when I started setting notes down for myself, were very, and still are very, disjointed, because it's so broad a topic. Merriam-Webster Dictionary Online, money.
Something generally accepted as a medium of exchange, a measure of value, or a means of payment. Officially coined or stamped metal currency.
And quite a few other listings for it. All right. Money. That's what it is officially, according to Merriam-Webster. Started out, how did it start out? Well, I suppose we have to go back to the world according to Quinn's gorilla. We'd have to go back to, actually, the world before that. The world before the invention of the plow, the massive adaptation of agriculture, and thus the adaptation and development of civilization, which evolved into the tangled mess we all live in today. Though it is a tangled mess, it allows us all those things that we've grown up to want. Books, movies, television, hot showers, antibiotics, and the internet. If we want all those things, if we want to keep those things, if we want to keep that rich history of creative endeavors, if we want all those things, we have to keep the taker civilization as defined by Quinn's gorilla in Ishmael. However, even before that, money would have been, as James put it, a couple of cows, chickens, polished wolf teeth, baskets, skins, that kind of thing, where that you would trade from one village or tribe to another. And I think it was when, I think it was primarily once the civilization thing started happening, that's when it switched over to that special heavy metal that was very tough to find. Not particularly useful as tools, but you could hammer it into neat and interesting jewelry and ornamentation, and it never rusted. Gold, of course. That became the next money. And over time, all the way up until today, what is now, what it has now become is a shapeshifter. It's become a shapeshifter. It's taken on that anthropomorphized persona, that entity, an identity unto itself that's become the master of the planet. For most people, from the very little money, just enough cash to keep yourself fed and in that apartment or tiny house or shack or whatever, it's those little pieces of paper and coins. They're physical objects. They're worthless in and of themselves. But you can't feed your family or you can't pay the rent without them on a very tiny scale. That's the shackle around the neck of Joe and Janet Public. It's a one-size-fits-all slavery, really. It's a shackle that grows depending on how far back you step. It is always a question of cost. But as far as what its definition is, yeah, when you look at it at that level, it's the physical objects. It's those pieces of paper. And it's not just in the United States. It's every other country. It's everywhere where civilization has taken firm hold. Then you get up into the loftier positions, whether it's in government or corporations. It's the top of the building stuff. It's the steel and glass skyscraper, big corner office world with the very well-dressed and overprivileged individuals that consider money really pretty much just an agreement between their other predators. Money becomes a concept. It's just it's a promise. It's a promise. It's promises made between peer predators. You do, of course, have to physically work far less to maintain that level of power. You also don't need to have knowledge of how to do anything in particular that's useful to people on a practical level. You just have to know how to make use of large numbers of other people. You have to know how to lie very effectively in order to maintain lots and lots of Well, money. And some would call that, well, that's capitalism. Okay, fine. Communism doesn't work any better. Communism doesn't work any better because you're still going to have tall steel buildings and big corner offices. You're just going to have predators that have different justifications. They just have a different justification for making use of other people. Same thing in a different suit. The whole idea, workers of the world unite, throw off your chains of oppression. You don't have to control the means of production. So, okay, you can do that. It still doesn't work because you're still holding on to civilization. You've still got to have that division of task where one guy actually builds the bridge with a bunch of other guys that know how to build bridges and work very long, hard, and dangerous jobs that require very definite skills, while another group is sitting somewhere in air conditioning looking out the window and moving words around and being paid more. Because you'll have that system. You'll have that system in place so long as you have civilization. You'll have people that are deciding on the rules. Well, the next rule that's going to be made is, well, maybe I get one more room in my apartment. Or maybe I get to sleep a little bit later than a couple other people because it helps me think more clearly. And maybe because, well, the pressure is just so high, I'm going to have to get away every once in a while so I get 2 more weeks vacation. And it starts out that way, and then it becomes a villa in the woods and a palace on the beach, because that's just the way it seems to work out among human beings if you're going to keep the taker civilization. Getting away from it as a concept and getting into it more as the tool that civilization adapted to regulate possessions, to regulate ownership of things and levels of standards of living, and getting more into the matter of choice. If you're a human being born on Earth today, you are born into a world where you have no choice but to acquire money or find one of those few remaining isolated places on Earth where you actually can live off the land. I don't know how many of those are left. But the choice you're making is give up the books, the movies, the television, the hot showers, the antibiotics, and the internet if you're going to go live there and do that. If you're going to become either that hermit or that small group of people that are going to attempt to do that, you'll have the somewhat insulting label placed upon your group as, oh, that's just a hippie commune. As if somehow anybody that involves themselves in something like that is of a lower value than other human beings who have decided to buckle down and put the nose to the grindstone and earn that money that they need to live the life that everybody else should be living. Your indoctrination to become a part of the economic machine begins very early. And some folks take to it very well, and some folks do very well by it. And I can't argue with the fairness of someone that works incredibly hard for a very long time to attain things within the system that they deserve because they've earned. I've got no argument with that whatsoever. It's a choice they've made. But the choices in the other direction are becoming fewer and fewer and fewer, depending on your mental health, and in some cases just depending on how lucky or unlucky you are, believe it or not, you may end up sleeping on a subway grate in order to get the warmth from the lower levels in the winter out on the street in the city. Wide range of possibilities.
Good man. Any more left?
Only this 50,000 pounds in loose silver.
Oh. Now, where can I hide that? I've got it. Moriarty, say ah.
Ah.
Now, Moriarty, keep your mouth shut. I don't want...
Army Pay Corps here. Chief Cashier speaking. Yes?
What? Moriarty! I'm sorry.
Yes, never mind about that. Moriarty, we're in the grit card now. Remember the third armored thunderboxes who vanished in Burma 10 years ago?
Yes.
Well, they're still alive.
Oh!
That was their commander, Seagoon.
Oh, type O! But they spent all their back pay.
Yes.
40,000 pounds. Sapristi, court martial, cashier, shot it down. Take aim, fire, bang.
Now, don't panic. My malodorous Gallic Charlie. We'll have to think of something else.
But that's examining it on a very close scale. That's examining it on a very practical, nuts and bolts, individual and community scale. What prompts the question? Why did I start asking this? Is money using us? What actually made me ask the question is I've been reading a lot of articles lately that in some cases make me hopeful and happy about knowledge and disciplined, talented, truth-seeking people, and some that make me very angry and upset because they're media spins that point the finger of blame at Joe and Janet Public, at you and me, at the average citizen. Let's be a little bit more clear on that. They're articles about energy. They're articles about global warming and the situation that civilization is in right now in terms of the use of fossil fuels, the warming of the planet, and where we're going. The articles that I like are the ones that show massive undertakings, large-scale attempts to use technology to generate energy that isn't oil, coal, or natural gas-based. Geothermal projects, solar projects, wind projects, on a very large scale. And hell, even some on a small scale, like that MP3 player with the wind-up power source. What I really like about it, what I really like about those articles, is they show that somebody somewhere is doing something. It isn't in the United States, of course. Not yet. Only recently have we started work on anything even approaching what they're doing in other countries. So far as not using oil, using something else. The articles that upset me and make me angry are the ones probably originating from the United States, pointing the finger at the public, saying that we've got to change our attitude about energy consumption. We have to be weaned off of oil. We've got to learn to change our minds about oil. And I think if I had a little more energy, and if I were more along the lines of, if this were more along the lines of a rant show, I would probably be ranting right now. I'd probably be enraged and foaming at the mouth and almost switching over into chipmunk voice to talk about the fact that we have no need to change our attitude about oil, because we don't have an attitude about oil. We don't care what source of energy lights the house or heats the house or what it is we specifically have to put into our car to make it go. We don't care about that. I have to insert this here because I listened to it again. Very sorry. This is a little jarring, but what I was really trying to say when I say we don't care where the energy comes from, that's not entirely true, and I can't really make that assumption for everybody. I end up doing that a lot on this show. I make assumptions about what other people think and feel and what they believe in, and I would prefer that nuclear energy also be phased out, as well as oil, because, of course, it presents the problem of what to do with the radioactive waste. That is a problem that can and will be solved, but it's not as if I don't care. I'm just making the point that Americans and people all over the world, the average citizen that has to buy something to put in their vehicle to get from point A to point B, knows that it doesn't have to be oil. As a matter of fact, would prefer that it wasn't. If the opportunity presents itself to purchase energy that comes from renewable sources, clean renewable sources, energy that is in line with the technology and the knowledge that we have today, we are more than willing to do so, and in fact are eager. We don't need our attitudes changed in that regard. We need the opportunity to make the switch. And again, we as the average citizens of the world don't have it within our power to do that, to make that change. Sorry, thank you. No, we don't need to change our attitude about energy. We know we don't want to use oil anymore. That we somehow have to be tricked or trained or guided like little children away from oil. I don't know. The last I looked, I checked in the sofas. I looked in the sofa cushions. I couldn't find billions of dollars to put towards research for alternative energy or large-scale projects that would produce it. I don't know. Have you checked behind the dresser for a couple of spare billions of dollars for that kind of thing? Also, last I checked, I checked my phone, for the quick dial numbers, the numbers you have programmed into, and I don't seem to have a direct line or influence over the design engineers that are building the cars that weigh 3 times more than they need to and are built to fall apart after a couple of years. I can't seem to get a hold of those guys and tell them to stop doing that. I will, I myself personally will put anything in my car that'll make it go. Hydrogen, whatever you want to use. Biomass, biofuels, not the way to go. Not the way to go. It's not renewable. It's an insane route to take. That basically, I guess what I'm saying here is that the people that are actually in control of, the people that actually have the power to make it happen, the people that actually have the ability to affect the real changes, in other words, the people that can sell me solar-generated electricity, the people that can sell me hydrogen, aren't exactly making it available. Stepping back away from the Earth, here we go. It's the IDDFOS way of looking at things. What am I reading in these articles? I am reading solar energy. Amazing. In 1 hour, the amount of energy that hits the Earth from the sun in 1 hour is equivalent to the amount of energy the whole world, all the human beings on Earth use in a year. Excellent. That's wonderful news. It's great to know that. Geothermal. I'm hearing all kinds of incredible things about what geothermal energy can do and how long it lasts. Wind power. Same thing. The technology is there. People, all of us, don't need to use oil. We don't need to use oil for energy now. Because the technology has already existed for some time to completely eliminate the need to burn oil, coal, natural gas. That knowledge of how to do that exists. It's been put into practical use in many different places. What am I reading in these articles again and again and again and again and again? I'm seeing the word affordable, economical, price barrier, expensive, cost effective. Money. We're looking at a planet that's overheating at a population that is growing at an outrageous rate and making use of incredible amounts of energy, fighting for, poisoning the planet, and being overcharged for something that we don't need to use anymore. And every argument over, well,
we'd love to switch to renewable energy sources, they're just too expensive. It costs too much to do it that way.
Money. It's the one-size-fits-all shackle in this particular instance. The tombstone of the human race is going to be,
yes, we could have saved ourselves, but it was just too expensive. We couldn't afford it.
As the human race being able to rescue itself from its own destruction, hearing this again and again in one article and commentary after another, well, it just costs too much and who's going to pay for it, is making me crazy. It's driving me nuts to hear this again and again and again. Now, if you want to point the finger at the average human being, at every man and every woman, at the public in general, the average citizen of the world, and say, this is your fault, do it because of overpopulation. Don't do it because we just can't seem to get over our addiction to oil. When you've got nothing else to make things go, why are you calling it an addiction? Is it the addiction of the average citizen to oil, or is it the addiction of those very few people in control of multinational corporations that are addicted to power and profit? What's your opinion? I'm afraid I was a little bit too disjointed and rambling on this. I just did not organize my thoughts on this vast, vast topic in a way that really made my point. The final, I guess my final point is, if we already know how to do all these things, is it just because we can't cooperate as human beings, or because we are so completely shackled by this worldwide agreement that money makes the world go round? It's the tail wagging the dog, in my opinion. It's supposed to be something we use. And it just has not only has become something that uses us, but something that is going to kill us if we don't get over it. I don't know. I think I'm going to go to closing music now. I'm afraid it was a little bit too bizarre on this last bit, so I may end up re-recording it. If not, I apologize. I apologize that I was all over the place with that, and just, it was almost a low-volume rant, wasn't it? Closing music is Bach. Why Bach? Why Johann Sebastian Bach? Well, because a couple of weeks ago, I played, nabbed the opening music to Mrs. Adam Five's podcast for the Horde Radio. She plays a piece, the beginning of a piece called Badinary, and that actually is what it's called, written by Johann Sebastian Bach. Badinary. How do you pronounce that? Badinary. Well, she played a modern version of it, and so did I. I played it as closing music. This is the actual, well, the traditional way of playing it in the actual music. And how about I just play it? It's a minute and 30 seconds. If you really hate classical, I'm sorry. It's only a minute and 30 seconds. If you really like classical, you'll recognize this piece immediately. Thank you. was. Ah, Bach. Yes, a MASH reference. All right. Well, we have reached the end of episode 56. And we're going to continue. Wait, Adam, there was no question for episode 57. Well, the question remains, actually. A few more insights from anybody that cares to write in, particularly if you've never written in before. Maybe you'll have some personal feelings on this one. Money. Has it become a tool that uses us? Is it in fact going to be the thing that kills us because we as a civilization decided that economics was more important than the survival of the human race? I would like to thank Kurt the Camera Guy for writing in weeks and weeks ago, and I lost that email. Shame on me. But I thank him very much for that email. I thank Tyson of the Northwest, Kyle, or Hobbit, and James, all for writing in for episode 56. I'd like to thank Ed, and Tashkal, and Dez, and Kurt for joining the forums. A late thank you to Ed, Kyle, Rokshasa, unidentified man in a baseball cap, and the trio of guys in New Zealand. Thank you all for joining the Frapper Map. And I'd like to thank you for listening to episode 56. The support music in the background for all of this has been The Once and Future Harp by Cheryl Ann Fulton. Yes, I made use of that the very first time I decided to use background music, and I used it again for this show because I really like it. Hope you like it too. That available from magnatune.com. And Badinary by Johann Sebastian Bach, that end closing music that I just played, was from an album called An Evening with Bach by Voices of Music. That also from magnatune.com. We are not evil. I hope you'll join us for episode 57. That, of course, will be the episode in which I explain why the podcast is called International Detective Dragons from Outer Space. But until then, I hope everything goes very well for you. And until then, best of days.
This is a thought. A thought. A thought. Remember, listen for another adventure of
International Detective Dragons from Outer Space.